Okay, I think we might start now. Welcome to Concurrent Session 2B, titled Risk Appetite, What the CEO and the Board Should Be Doing. My name is Martin Paino, and I'll be the chair of this session. Today's presenter is Ian Lachlan. Ian was appointed as a member of APRA on 1 July 2010 for a three-year term. Ian has extensive experience in the financial services industry. He has been a non-executive director of AMP Life Limited, serving as a chairman of the Board Audit Committee, managing director of the United Kingdom Life Insurance subsidiaries of AMP, a director of HHG PLC, and non-executive director of Diligenta Limited in the UK. And before then, Ian held senior management positions in AMP, Suncorp, National Mutual in Australia, New Zealand and Hong Kong. Ian is a qualified actuary and has served on the council of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. Before I hand over to Ian, a few housekeeping points. First of all, Ian will present for around 20 minutes. Then we're going to open up for questions for around 20 minutes, and then Ian's going to then present for another 10 minutes, and then we'll have another 10 minutes of questions. When asking questions or making a comment, please ensure that you use the microphone and state your name, and please keep any comments to a maximum of 2 minutes. So over to you, Ian.
Thanks very much, Martin. My main aim today is to generate some discussion. Discussion on how we, that is the industry, the profession and APRA, can improve the articulation and management of risk appetite by CEOs and boards in particular. Now, why would we want to do that? Let's have a look at a bit of context. I'll first spend a little bit of time on what risk appetite is, some of the challenges it presents, and why it is so important. And then I'll talk about APRA's thinking. And lastly, if we have time, I'll talk on how actuaries might be able to help in all of this. So let's have a look at recent history, first of all. Of course, we've seen a string of failures in financial services organisations in recent years, and none of these names will be new to you, except maybe the bottom left-hand one, which happened last week in New Zealand. So we've had a string of failures. We all know that. I think we would all accept that it wasn't just bad luck, okay, and that inadequate risk management had a significant role to play. More specifically, was the appetite for risk unclear in these businesses? Maybe the appetite was beyond the capacity of the business. That is, there was a willingness to take risk that the business simply couldn't cope with. Or maybe the risk was beyond appetite. And why would that have happened? Maybe through poor management, maybe through fraud, maybe through deliberate non-compliance. Whatever the reasons, there's been a significant shift in the attitude to risk management, and generally speaking, risk management as a discipline is developing strongly and is now high on the agenda for most boards and CEOs. And most boards and CEOs, particularly in the financial services world, would increasingly see robust risk management as a fundamental capability for running the business. Now, in carrying out their responsibilities to protect customer interests, and I stress their responsibilities to protect customer interests, the board and management of financial services companies have various tools they can use, but in simple terms, there are two big levers. First of all, there's the capital lever. So the more capital there is, the more protection there is for customers. And the second big lever is the risk management lever. The better the risk management, the better the protection for customers. So not surprisingly, APRA takes a very keen interest in how management and the board use these two levers. And the thing to note for today's discussion is that APRA is vitally interested in the quality and effectiveness of risk management. And as I'll explain, risk appetite, the topic for today, is a fundamental building block of sound risk management. And so APRA sees robust risk appetite management as critical for its regulated entities. And before I go into detail, it's worth noting that there's now some quite good reference material out there on the web, and I'll just put a few of them up here. So the main consulting firms have got quite interesting documents. There are a couple of other presentations that are worth referring to. Now, what are we talking about? What exactly is risk appetite? The concept is often misunderstood, and there often is confusion amongst various terms such as appetite, tolerance, and capacity. I took these definitions from Ernst & Young, but you'll find them in other places as well. So let's just have a look at them, and it's really quite important to understand the differences. First one's about the capacity, the amount and type of risk an organisation is able to support in pursuit of its business objectives. And in simple terms, that's how much capital has it got. The second one is what appetite it has, what risk it's willing to accept and willing and able to accept in pursuit of its business objectives. And then tolerance is normally used when you're talking about specific risks in a narrower sense, and you're normally talking about quantifiable and measurable limits. And the last one is less used, but it's worth noting. That is that you may well have a target position for your risk, which is different to your tolerance. You might tolerate it out here, but you really would prefer it to be back in here. Now, I draw your attention in particular to the difference between appetite and capacity because they're often confused. While capital may be available, the company may have no desire to risk all of that capital in pursuit of its objectives. You need to understand that. Now, it's also worth mentioning economic capital in this context. Economic capital can be used in a variety of ways in the management of the business. For example, it can be used in the quantification of the risk profile of the business as it stands. However, this doesn't necessarily mean that it's a measure of the risk appetite of the business. Economic calculations, capital calculations, may well be useful input to the company's determination of its appetite, and this may drive a change in its risk profile. The main thing here to understand is the concept of risk appetite. Okay, whose appetite? Oops, sorry, let me go back. Whose appetite is it? It's worth noting that ERM, risk management generally, is often looked at through the eyes of the shareholder, and that's not a great surprise given the focus of most boards. However, financial services companies have very strong obligations to protect the interests of their customers. And APRA, too, of course, is very interested in policyholders and depositors rather than shareholders. So it's critical that risk appetite considers all of the relevant stakeholders and not just shareholders. Sometimes the risk management interests of shareholders and customers are aligned, but sometimes they're not. Indeed, they can be at odds with each other. This is particularly true for life participating business. But there are other examples as well, and I won't go into it now, but FinCorp, you might remember, collapsed a couple of years ago as a classic example of misalignment of interests of shareholders and customers. So how do we express risk appetite? It's one thing to have a risk appetite. It's another to express it clearly and unambiguously in a way that generates a common understanding. In practice, it can and is expressed in a variety of ways. Often it's very high level and very qualitative, but it can be detailed and include quantitative measures. And sometimes you get a mix of both. And this slide just gives you some words. It's just a bit of an indication of the flavour that you get when you see a risk appetite statement which is very qualitative, the black words, and the sort of thing that you might expect in a more quantitative statement. Now, there's no sort of accepted good practice at the moment. This is still evolving, but over time you would expect best practice to evolve, and certainly APRA is going to try and help nudge that along a little bit. Now, whatever way a risk appetite is expressed, it's necessary to translate it into operational measures that can be used in various parts of the business and for different types of risks. So we need to translate the appetite into tolerances for operational purposes. These need to be as quantifiable and measurable as possible. And so these are the sort of words that you might see when looking at tolerances deeper down in the business. And again, as I say, they should be measurable wherever possible and preferably quantifiable. Now, the translation from appetite to tolerance can be a bit of a challenge. It needs to accommodate the various audiences, the different parts of the business, and all of the major risks. So you see something like this, starting up here at the appetite, goes down into the business, the various business units, and the various risks by type. and generally quantitative, sometimes a mixture, as I've explained. And this needs to be done in a coordinated and consistent way across the business. So practical information about interpretation of the appetite, tolerances adopted, etc., needs to be shared and compared across the business and across types of risks. Inconsistencies can then be addressed and tolerances adjusted. And once there's consistency, information can be fed back to the board. So you've then got a bit of a feedback loop going. And the board can satisfy itself that the tolerances being adopted are indeed consistent with what the board intended with the risk appetite. Now, one of the dangers with the risk appetite is that you get a nice set of words, maybe half produced by a firm of consultants, and everybody sits there and nods wisely and says, yes, this is a nice statement. But in everybody's mind, it means something different, okay? And that's quite dangerous. So once up and running, experience needs to be monitored and corrective action taken in the manner of a control cycle. So you might find changes in the market or in particular parts of the business that alter your expectations or the risk that you're willing to take in the business unit, or maybe the type of risk because the market has changed. You change your tolerance in response, and you go into the loop again. So all of this is reasonably hard to do well. The articulation, the translation into tolerances, the coordination and the monitoring and corrective action. Risk appetite needs to be factored into strategic plans. It makes no sense for it to be developed in isolation from strategy or vice versa, and yet you do see that happening. So, for example, targeted return on capital must be entirely consistent with risk appetite. So it's no good saying, you know, I've got a modest risk appetite and setting a high return on capital. Chances are the two are just incompatible. And capital management plans also must reflect risk appetite. For example, it may make no sense if risk appetite as expressed is high, but supply of capital is constrained. And I'll talk about more on that in a minute. Now, let's have a look at some APRA requirements to give us a bit more context. APRA makes it clear that the board is primarily responsible for the risk management framework. And it defines risk management framework quite broadly. I won't go into details, but it really is defined quite broadly. The risk management framework includes the risk management strategy. And amongst other things, the risk management strategy has to include a risk appetite statement. So the board then is responsible for setting the company's risk appetite. And as I've mentioned, a well-considered, clearly articulated risk appetite is the very foundation of sound risk management. Without this, risk management throughout the business will be carried out with unclear boundaries. And of course, it will be built on a rocky or a wobbly foundation. So setting risk appetite should be top, not somewhere in the periphery, but should be top of the risk management list for the board. Now, you'll recall that as part of LAGIC, review of capital requirements for the life and general insurance industry, we're introducing the three pillar concept, and I'll just remind you of what that means. Pillar one is the quantitative requirements in relation to the required capital, eligible capital, and liability valuations. So that's the formulaic approach. And pillar two is a supervisory review process, which may include an adjustment to capital. Okay, so APRA will have the power to look at the calculation, look at the company, and make an adjustment. Pillar three is the disclosure requirements designed to encourage market discipline. Now, under Pillar two, APRA may increase the prescribed capital determined under Pillar one if we think that Pillar one doesn't adequately account for all of the insurer's risks, or if we think the risk management is inadequate. This diagram, which has come out of our recent response paper, will explain a little bit more. I'll use it to help explain what I'm talking about. The prudential capital requirement, that's the PCR on the diagram, is the outworking of Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. Now, the PCR is a hard floor, okay, so it's not to be breached. And the one analogy I like to use is that breaching PCR is like an insurer putting its foot in boiling water. You've got to get it out real quick, or APRA will be sitting beside you, potentially taking away the control of the business from the board and management. So it needs to be taken very seriously. So the insurer then is expected to set a target level of capital, which is in excess of the PCR, up there somewhere. And in particular, the ICAP, the Individual Capital Adequacy Assessment Process, which is shown on the right-hand side there, is a process to assess capital needs and to manage capital levels. The insurer is expected to manage its capital according to ICAP and its target capital policy. And in particular, we want insurers to assess their own risk profile and the capital needed to support the risks they undertake. So we're not prescribing where targets should be. We're going back to the companies and saying, you understand the risks in the business, so you must understand the risks in your business. You need to put in place an ICAP process to manage the capital position above PCR. And it's here that risk appetite comes into play. So the insurer should be clear on its appetite for breaching PCR and of ultimately not being able to meet its obligations to policyholders. And this needs to be considered alongside any other aspects of risk appetite, such as the volatility in profit. So again, you know, you've got to look at the different stakeholders. Volatility of profit may be a measure for shareholders, but when it comes to policyholders, when it comes to prudential management, you've got different issues you've got to take into account. So the target capital position, the ICAP and risk appetite should be considered together and managed accordingly. It's worth noting that stress testing is likely to be a very useful tool in setting risk appetite and in developing target capital and the ICAP on the diagram here. And as you can see, on the left-hand side of the coloured box, the supervisory attention paid to an insurer will increase in intensity as the insurer's actual capital approaches the PCR. So it's okay if the capital falls below target, so long as it's recognised in the ICAP and the business is being managed accordingly. However, as it gets closer to PCR, then APRA will take a much closer interest. Now, in recent times, APRA has reviewed the risk appetite statements from a number of general insurers and life insurers and spoken to a number of CEOs and boards about the engagement of the board in the risk appetite process. In summary, here's what we've found. In some cases, there's no clear statement of risk appetite, so there might be some reference to the fact that we've got a risk appetite. When you go hunting for it, you won't find it. And incidentally, generally speaking, you won't find a statement of risk appetite in the public domain. So if you go onto the website for the big banks, you won't find it. One of the issues for us as APRA is that sometimes you won't find it under the covers as well. And clearly that's not acceptable. Secondly, there's a wide range of approaches to articulating risk appetite. And as I said earlier, that practice is still evolving. So what we're seeing is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just something that we need to understand. The quality of the statement of risk appetite ranges from poor to quite good. There's a lack of analysis of risk appetite through the use of scenario analyses, stress testing, and so on. So I was describing before how it would be very useful to use stress testing in the development of the ICAP and in the development of the target capital position. It's not always clear that the board has been heavily engaged in setting the risk appetite. They're responsible. They need to be engaged. In some cases, there's a disconnect between the risk appetite statement and its translation into operational management, into the tolerances. And last, with some subsidiaries or branches of foreign-owned insurers, we see an adoption of group risk management practices without necessarily full and proper engagement of local management and or board. Now, it's worth reflecting on these points in the context of my earlier comments on the fundamental importance of risk appetite. And as a first response to this analysis, we've been developing a checklist for our supervisors. That's the people that actually go and monitor each of the organisations. So what the supervisors should be looking for in a company's approach to risk appetite. Now, I'm very keen that what I'm about to tell you is discussed. So I'm very interested in your comments here. This is very much a work in progress, and we expect it to evolve and develop over coming years. So, and what I'm about to show you is internal guidelines. Okay, so this is guidelines for our people But you can expect in due course it'll be translated into guidelines for the industry, but not until we've got a better feel for it, not until we've had input from industry and seen it work in practice. We've identified four broad areas for assessment: governance, risk management, implementation, and communication. So in each of these areas, we're looking at risk appetite. So under governance, let's have a look at the items we'll be looking at. First one is that we want to see evidence that the board has been engaged in the development of the risk appetite and has demonstrated ownership by its approval in relevant documents, etc. Now, in practice, we also meet with boards. So I meet quite regularly with boards, and pretty well every time that I meet with a board, risk appetite is on the agenda. And again, on this first point, we need to draw the distinction between a nicely crafted risk appetite statement that's been produced with the help of consultants and real engagement by the board. The second point is that the risk appetite must consider the interests and expectations of the different stakeholders. So I've already talked about the need to consider depositors and policyholders as well as shareholders. We need to see that the risk appetite is periodically reviewed in the context of the prevailing economic conditions and competitive environment. In other words, you don't want a risk appetite statement, no matter how well produced, then put on the shelf and sort of dust it off every now and then when you need to, when APRA is visiting. But it needs to live and breathe, and it needs to be adjusted to take into account the circumstances. Fourth, we need to see a feedback loop that enables the board to understand how management interprets and applies the risk tolerances and limits, to be satisfied that the management's interpretation and application of the risk appetite is appropriate, and to review the risk appetite statement in light of these factors. And you might remember the earlier slide where I was trying to convey the idea of a feedback loop. The risk appetite statement needs to be reasonable. So this is the man on the Clapham omnibus. The risk appetite statement needs to appear reasonable, make sense, and be able to be readily understood. And lastly, on this slide, within group structures, we need to see that there's a group risk appetite statement and that there's an appetite statement for each entity which is consistent with the group appetite statement. Let's move on to the next area, which is headed risk management. The risk appetite needs to consider all material types of risks of the entity. So it needs to make sure that it considers all of the significant risks across the business, and often you'll see them much more narrowly focused than that, and clearly that's just not acceptable. The risk appetite statement needs to be core to the risk management framework, and it needs to set clear boundaries and expectations. It needs to be supported by tolerances and limits which are embedded in the business. So again, back to the earlier diagram, high-level risk appetite statement, tolerances specified lower down in the business and actually used for operational management. And the use for operational management is an important test. And the risk appetite needs to be considered when assessing the adequacy of controls in mitigating risks. So you've got a whole range of controls in a business to manage the risk in the business. If they are not in sync with the risk appetite, then one of them is wrong. Either your appetite is wrong or the controls are wrong. The next area for consideration was implementation. We need to be sure that the entity's strategic objectives and business plans must be consistent with the risk appetite. Earlier on, I said you need to develop the two in sync. You can't have them barking at each other. They need to support each other. Second point here is that the entity's capital management plan needs to be consistent with the risk appetite. So capital levels and targets need to be monitored and reported against the risk appetite. So there's no good, again, reporting back to the board that you've got risk appetite this high and the board is unwilling to supply capital to support that level of risk appetite. And the last point here is that risks necessary to produce the required returns on capital are within the risk appetite. That is, there's no point in having a high target return on capital if there's an expressed risk appetite, which is low. The two don't go hand in glove. And the last area is communication. There needs to be relevant communication of the entity's risk appetite and its derived tolerances and limits to each part of the entity's operation. So again, it's no good having a nice process at the board if it doesn't find its way down into the bowels of the organisation. And likewise, there's no point in just sending it one way. You need to have this feedback loop. Second point here is that the board regularly receives reporting on the entity's level of risk relative to its risk appetite. So via metrics for measuring the position against the tolerances and limits. And it needs to be engaged, that is, the board needs to be engaged in assessing the relevant implications of this information. So again, it's not just reporting, it's what does it mean? Are we operating, are we comfortable with where we're operating in accordance with our risk appetite, or are we not? And the last point here is that scenario analysis and stress testing needs to be performed against the risk appetite and reported to the board in order to confirm that the risk appetite doesn't exceed its risk capacity. So I hope this helps understand the process we plan to follow. I stress again that this is work in progress and it'll continue to develop based on the experience in the field and the feedback from the market. And today's session is just such an opportunity. So I thought I might stop there. I've got a little bit more that we can talk about, which is about how actuaries might be able to help in this process. But I thought it might help if we stop here and open it to discussion, Martin. So over to you.
Would anyone like to ask a question? Do we have a microphone?
Hi, Ian, thanks for that. This is an issue, Tim Chambers from AIA, this is an issue we're kind of grappling with ourselves at the organisation. We've really sort of, I guess, been involved with engaging the board and the management team and the staff around the whole risk appetite area. We've got risk management frameworks and all that. We've you know, established a risk appetite statement and all around our the risk of breaching capital adequacy within a certain period, et cetera. And you know, pretty much everybody's kind of eating risk appetite for lunch at the company at the moment. But the next stage is really about rolling it out. And when you talk about risk tolerances and risk limits and putting those in place, we're finding that quite a difficult exercise in terms of pushing it out down the business. And when you go along to a lot of these kind of presentations, you kind of hear a lot about this, about, once you've established your risk appetite statement, and then you push it out to the business. But in terms of practically doing that and establishing risk tolerances and risk limits at a business unit level, when you go to, underwriting or new business or the customer call centre, and you start talking to them about your risk appetite statement and all the quantitative stuff you've got in there, doesn't really mean very much. It's very difficult to apply it at that level. So just wondered whether you've got anything you could sort of maybe add around that step, or what you've seen, or what you're kind of really expecting there.
Well, first of all, it is difficult. So what you've just said is no great surprise. You'll find that that's a pretty common experience. Secondly, you need people who understand the risk appetite, so senior people who understand the risk appetite, the strategy, the context, and so on, and who understand the operations to act as translators. So it's no good sort of walking along to people down in the middle of the business and saying, well, here's our high-level risk appetite statement. Good luck. Let us know how you go. That's not going to work. So you need senior people, and we may get onto this in a sec, and I think actuaries are pretty well placed to do this sort of work, but you need senior people who can talk both languages, so can talk high-level strategically and can talk operationally and make sure that they're consistent. You then have a further difficulty, of course, as I said earlier, you've got to make sure they're consistent across the business as well. And so when you look at it collectively, it's in compliance with the risk appetite for the business as a whole. So it is difficult.
Hi, Rick Shaw. One of the drivers behind risk management from regulators and a lot of people is that it should be organic. It should be, in the bones of an organisation. And I wonder though, if the risk management structures are being promulgated by the regulator, the extent to which it becomes an issue in compliance rather than a fruitful issue in itself. And just following up from your comment then about the how actuaries can be kind of useful, if we look at the list of companies that fell over that you started with, is that they're all banks, or it was a banking part, the non-insurance, and particularly the non-general insurance part of the organisations which caused the problems. And one of my reflections on that is that I think that the actuarial profession is practising the processes of risk management in such a manner that the insurance company came up a little bit smelling like roses from the global financial crisis. And I have some concern. When I hear in the opening session today, Desmond Smith said that his CEO is spending 30% of his time on compliance costs, on compliance issues. I have some concern that the act of the regulator in promulgating these standards may go against making these practices organic in an organisation.
Let me start with the compliance issue first, and I think that is a valid concern. APRA's standards are not written in great detail. They are intended to be principles-based. However, there are quite specific requirements in those standards, and there is a danger that companies, boards and management will look at what's in those standards and say, yes, you know, we can tick that box and we can tick that box and we can tick that box. That is not what we're about, okay? What we're trying to do is to get the board and management to think about these things and in many ways to regard our standards as a framework that indicates good practice and in some ways gives them a reference point. So we don't want to see them looking at our standards with a compliance mindset. Easier said than done, but absolutely we don't want that. You then spoke a little bit about the failures earlier on, and of course those failures were primarily brought about in the as a result of the GFC, and the GFC has its roots primarily in banking, and so you do see we have seen a lot of failures in banking and banking related companies. But as a regulator, of course, we've got to look beyond that. We can't just focus on yesterday's wars, winning yesterday's wars. We have to look beyond that. And I can tell you, I spent quite a bit of time in the UK personally dealing with companies, insurance companies, that were really struggling to stay afloat. So it can happen in insurance just as easily as it can happen in the banking world. And I think we do need to be careful when looking at the actuarial profession and in believing that fundamentally we're going to manage risks in an organisation better than other people are going to do so. I think as a profession we've got an awful lot to offer, but it doesn't mean that we're head and shoulders above everybody else. There's another one there. Yeah.
Ralph Blanchard, Cash Actuarial Society. I've studied over the years, you know, all the relevant failures, studied long-term capital, AIG, Lehman Brothers. Yeah. The observation from those, you know, reading it, is that many times the managements involved were very quantitatively oriented.
Yeah.
They had risk management evaluation processes. They just were, the misstep was in the misestimation of risk, not understanding risk over time, the assumptions underlying the risk analysis. So it wasn't really risk appetite or failure of the board to be involved. It was actually in the evaluation of the risk and almost a preference to believe the person's evaluation of risk that's generating the most earnings.
Yep.
So I'm looking for your perspective, given that I don't see adding on here as really getting at the root causes of past problems.
Okay. And indeed, you're quite right. This isn't what I'm talking about today is not intended to say this is the way you would solve the problems of the GFC. It's not. The message I'm trying to give is that risk appetite, clearly articulated, well-managed risk appetite, is fundamental to good risk management. If you haven't got it, then there's a fair chance you're not going to manage risk well. So it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. You need to go on well beyond risk appetite. But the point I'm making is that it is fundamental. If you get this wrong, you're off to a very bad start. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I don't know whether it's really getting at the core. It makes sense, but I don't know if it's really getting at the core because, again, it wasn't. I don't think going further here is going to add. Some companies that did well didn't have this as well defined, but they had a more innate sense of what was going on. They were relying less on the quantitative and more on this. This just doesn't smell right. When I read the past histories, the companies that didn't get snookered in were the ones who said this didn't smell right. It wasn't the quantitative processes that could be well documented. It was more just the probably just more competent management.
Yeah, I'd say maybe more competent management and better engagement of the boards. Okay, so if you've got a well-performing board, they're not going to be looking at the quantitative detail or the models or whatever. They're meant to be sitting up here and doing some sanity checks. And if boards sit and just accept what management's putting in front of them, then they're much more exposed to these sorts of problems. If, on the other hand, they really are engaged in their risk management process. And in Australia, in our prudential standards, we make it very clear, as I was saying, that we expect the boards to be really engaged in this process, then that will make a fundamental difference.
Ken Griffin, Ernst & Young. Just a question in terms of what I call risk culture. During the GFC, I wasn't at Ernst & Young, I was somewhere else. And one of the things that changed for me in the perception of risk management at that point was more of a view that it was about people.
Yep.
So if you'd asked me before the GFC, I would have said governance, policies, metrics, risk reporting, systems, processes. The thing that really struck me during the GFC was it was about having people as prepared as they could be to be able to respond to the circumstances. And you could have all the rest of it, but if you didn't have the right people in the right place, being able to act and be as prepared as possible, it was for naught. Where does the sort of the board view of risk appetite and understanding the process fit into understanding what that people capability is on your front line?
Yeah, okay. There are a couple of points there that are important. Firstly, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And in many ways, what this is about is driving behaviour and thinking in the company rather than some process or some compliance with some rules. It's about making boards think about the business as a whole and how risks should be managed across the business. And it's about then permeating that in the organisation. One of the things that I've found is that if boards take a very serious interest in an issue, it doesn't really matter what the issue is, then the organisation sits up and take notice. Okay, if the board gives an issue sort of cursory attention, then chances are that will flow down through the organisation. So that's one reason why we are focused on boards. If we can drive behaviour at the boards, it will influence the way the organisation actually works. And I said earlier, I meet with boards on a regular basis. And I might have missed one, but I reckon just about every meeting I've raised the topic of risk appetite and we've talked about it. And the reason for that is that I think it's fundamentally important to the way the board does its job and the way it then influences the way the organisation operates. So quite consistent with your point, it's just one of the tools in the kit bag.
Ian, we've got 20 minutes to go, so do you want to continue with the questions?
Let's carry on for a little bit more. Yeah, I think there's a bit of interest in it.
Hi, Ian. Michael Stumbles from Deloitte. When you talked about governance, I didn't hear any mention of remuneration. How do you see remuneration playing a role in sort of embedding this in the business?
Yep. It is in the list of things where I think actuaries can help, actually. I might come back to that. So, yes, as you probably know, APRA introduced requirements for remuneration for regulated entities as from 1 April last year. And what that is about is trying to make sure that the way people are remunerated is consistent with the risk appetite of the business. So what you don't want to – you want to avoid encouraging an individual or a part of the business to have – a personal risk appetite, which is way out of sync with the risk appetite of the organisation. And that's what happened with some of these failures in the GFC. So you had parts of the business taking huge bets completely out of step with
the risk appetite of the business as a whole, and I think AIG is probably a good example of that, but there are plenty of others. And so the remuneration requirements that we've put in place are intended to try and get all of those things more aligned than they might otherwise be. We're only partway through that process, by the way. So we're about to start a second round of engagement with companies. Excuse me. Beg your pardon. We're about to start a second round of engagement with companies, talking to their remuneration committees, so at the board level again. And you can be sure that when we're talking to them about remuneration, we'll be talking to them about this at the same time.
Dave Morris. I'm doing this from the perspective of being a non-executive director of a life company and had pleasure of your lunch and discussions about risk appetites. But it is actually incredibly difficult, I think, for non-executive directors, and even more so, I guess, if they're not actuaries, to get to grips with what risk appetite is about and getting something that is a statement. We found it was incredibly useful, just the discussion, and particularly finding out from our shareholder what their particular view of risk appetite was. And what we ended up with, we actually started with a reasonably complex system, or way of expressing it, but I think in the end we simplified it to something that everyone could understand. And we're in the process, and this comes back to communication, of actually trying to produce a one-page expression of risk appetite that can actually go to everyone so they actually understand, because there's been a heck of a focus about risk management and managing risks and compliance and all those things. But actually getting it down to the people who, on a day-to-day basis, actually carry that out is quite difficult.
Yep, it is. Dave, I think you hit on a really important point there, that going through the sorts of things that we're talking about here is one thing. You can go through it and you'll get some value out of it. But a lot of the value emerges from the debate, because you find that different people have different perspectives and you start discussing it. And that in turn improves the whole quality of risk management. So as a catalyst for debate, this is really valuable as well.
Next question.
Shall I just go on? I've got a couple of comments here on how actuaries might help, and that might trigger another couple of questions. Now, of course, in recent years, the world has become a lot more complex, and risk management thinking has evolved well beyond the boundaries of traditional actuarial thinking. And as I mentioned earlier, it's now widely acknowledged that risk management is fundamentally important for the sound management of any complex organisation. Now, APRA already entrusts the profession, the actuarial profession, with important responsibilities beyond traditional actuarial boundaries. And one in particular worth noting is the requirement for the appointed actuary to sign off on the suitability and adequacy of the risk management framework. Now, at the moment, that's not well defined. Well, it's not defined at all, what that actually means. But I would say that for somebody to sign off on a risk management framework that was suitable and adequate, they would have to consider the sort of things I've been talking about today. So if you're signing off in your FCR that a risk management framework is suitable and adequate, and you haven't really challenged yourself by going through the sort of topics that I just discussed, the chances are that the foundation for your sign-off is not as strong as it might be. I've explained the fundamental importance of risk appetite. So actuaries need to be well and truly up to speed on the topic generally. But well before the process, that is the process we've been talking about, actuaries can help in a variety of ways. So, for example, in articulation of the risk appetite. As I mentioned earlier, you need people who can understand the operational parts of the business as well as the higher level strategic thinking
and very often the actuary is in a great position, or actuaries are in a great position to act as the translator, which is the next point. And very often the actuaries or the appointed actuary will have a view across the whole business and is able to pull it all together and make sure it's coordinated. So an understanding of the financial dynamics of the company, its products and its markets are a great help in articulation. That then extends into the determination of the tolerances, coordination and so on. And now there are a couple of more specific areas where actuaries might help. We were talking about remuneration requirements before, and amongst other things, what we're seeking there is a stronger linking of remuneration with the risk taken and consistency of with risk appetite. So a better understanding of the capital backing business results will be important. In other words, remuneration should reflect, as one measure, the return on capital and the risk being taken in generating that return, and actuaries are ideally placed to help with that process. The ICAP process, you remember the colourful diagram before, and the ICAP process managing the capital position above PCR. That has to incorporate risk appetite, and it needs technical skills, business skills, and communication and interpretation. And again, within the insurance industry, there are a few that are better placed to do that work. And lastly, I've mentioned more use of stress testing and reverse stress testing and how that can be of real help to boards and senior management in understanding the risk profile of the business and in helping to set risk appetite. So there are a number of areas, I think, where actuaries can help. So I might just stop there and see whether or not that generates some comments and questions.
Any questions? Mike?
Mike Thornton, just one comment and one question, Ian. So a comment, I think for risk appetite to work well, you're right, you know, risk appetite needs to be able to be cascaded down to an operational level where the risks can be proactively managed before they become problems at an organisational level. Yep. The challenge, I think, is doing that consistently across all the risks in an organisation. Doing it in one area or another can be straightforward, but doing it completely and consistently, I think, is very hard. So just giving you some feedback for a moment on the guidance. The bar looks quite high from my perspective.
Yep.
The question is around where you see this fitting into the broader regulatory framework. You mentioned that you see some guidelines coming at some stage.
Yep.
So where is that going to fit into the regulatory framework as you see it?
Okay. Mike, you're right. I think we are setting the bar high, but I think we should do that. That doesn't mean to say that everybody will comply automatically from day one. They won't. We already know that. But we should set the expectations high. The standards are high. That's our expectation. So no apologies for doing that. It's just a question of how we manage their implementation over a period of time, which comes to your second point. And we've yet to work out how it might translate into formal regulation, but it could start off in PPGs, for example, before it finds its way into prudential standards, and I suspect that's what we'll do. So you might find that it actually takes a number of years before it becomes formalised. And I think that's good. I think it gives plenty of opportunity for the industry to understand where we're going, to give us feedback. We might modify our approach. We might find we are setting the bar too high and we need to change it. But that's the idea of floating these things and getting input from industry.
Next question.
I think we've got one here, David.
David Goodsall from Singer Noble. I certainly agree with where you're heading, and I think it's excellent that the regulator's taking the step of providing a more tangible framework on what this actually looks like. Picking up on Dave Morris's point, it does need to be comprehensible, in which case you'll go more to the qualitative enunciation initially. And I think actuaries need to be very careful in supporting that rather than going to the quantitative too early. Because the risk is if you put a number on it, like 1% chance of not meeting something, that's all very well for well-behaved risks. But the things that get you are the risks that aren't well-behaved, and they either happen or they don't. It's not an average. And it's just very important that actuaries are dealing with what you do in the event of these things occurring, as opposed to trying to put a number on something that's not quantifiable. And following on from that, I'd have a request that your very capable staff don't try and force the tolerances and limits to be quantified before the industry is ready. And as you said, that may take some time.
Yep. Look, I'm pretty comfortable with what you've just said, David, and I think it's worth noting that the composition of the typical board includes people with a range of different backgrounds, and a lot of them aren't necessarily quantifiably focused, if that's the right term. And I think a risk appetite statement needs to recognise that, particularly if it's going to be really owned by the board. Okay, well, look, we might finish there, I think. Just very quickly, and so one more question. Yep.
And just a question regarding the level of dynamism, or how dynamic risk appetite actually is for the board. Just, we've had a few tumultuous years in the last few years, but it does seem that risk appetite for companies can change quite quickly, not just in terms of the external environment, but also where they sit in the industry. So if there's a systematic problem across the industry, it's very different to if you're the one sitting out there with a problem and nobody else has it.
Yep.
What's your expectations around how dynamic you'd expect these statements to be and how the board would approach that?
Yeah, I think they should be quite dynamic. That doesn't mean to say that they change on a regular basis, but the board should be, and senior management should be, willing to sit down and debate it and give themselves comfort that it should either stay where it is or it should be shifted to reflect the current market conditions or the economy or whatever it is that's driving their thinking, but it should not be static.
We've actually got a few more minutes. We're not due to finish till 5 past, so if there are any more questions, we can keep going. Or is everyone keen to get to lunch?
Let me summarise very briefly. Risk appetite is the very foundation of sound risk management. It's not sufficient. Sorry, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Absolutely fundamental to robust risk management. It's difficult but critical to clearly articulate the risk appetite, to translate it into risk tolerances, to coordinate, and a couple of people spoke about how difficult that is, coordinate risk positions by type and business unit, and to monitor the risk and take corrective action as required. We spoke about a feedback loop. APRA is increasing its intensity of supervision in this area, and you should expect that we will improve our skills as we gain experience. And lastly, actuaries are pretty well placed to help make it all work. It's just a matter of grabbing the opportunity, I think. So thank you very much, and I hope you found that useful.